you were here during our meeting this past week, you learned that two of our four air conditioning units are out. And so the lights are dimmed to try to keep the heat down. I think it keeps it down about 4 degrees. And I told Pam afterward, I said, well, that's pretty tranquil sitting there listening in that, but I sure don't want it while I'm preaching. So I'm watching, make sure everybody's staying awake this morning as we try to keep it down a little bit in here. When someone has the opportunity to be in public, to speak in public, there is a strong temptation to go beyond what brought you into the public eye to state your opinions. For example, we oftentimes will have our celebrities from Hollywood that will tell us how we should be feeling about all of the issues of the day. The same thing is true for the world of music. In fact, there was one entertainer this week that came out and said that if you disagreed with her opinion, she didn't want you listening to her music. And I said, I can live with the terms of that deal. That's just fine. But there's also that same temptation for preachers. And while I certainly don't think that I've got the same public avenue as someone who's a Hollywood celebrity or in the music world, I do know that speaking publicly, there is a temptation, as I assume most men would have who have this opportunity, to use this venue to tell my opinion on things. And so I really guard myself against that and really just try my very best not to comment on things that aren't related to the preaching of the gospel. But there are occasions that come along when you've got something that's going on in the public world of current events that intersects with what we do here. In other words, something that's being discussed, something that's being decided in the public realm is crossing over into spiritual things. And we know that for the past 2 weeks, that has been the case. This decision that was made by the court concerning abortion has been spoken of by celebrities, by entertainers, by politicians. And those that have had the loudest voices have dominated the old media, the TV media and radio, the new media, social media, plus all the rest of us who wanted to could take to social media and put our ideas out there. So there has just been this cacophony of voices going on, yay and nay on both sides of this. And what's intriguing about this is that 9 people who 99% of Americans could not list if they had to, have suddenly been dominating everybody's attention. And 6 of those, because of their decision to overturn this 50-year-old precedent in the Supreme Court that we call Roe versus Wade, that made abortion legal throughout the United States, what these justices said is we're not declaring it illegal, we're just punting it back to the states. So state legislatures can make their own decisions about it. They can pass their own laws about it. It's up to them. And so this has created this really loud discussion that's kind of been somewhat in the background for the past 50 years. I don't know that this decision has really changed anybody's mind on the matter of abortion. I doubt that typical American said, oh, well, the Supreme Court made this decision. Now I'm totally different than what I used to feel about it. But yet it has brought the debate back to the surface. And so it may be that you have been in surroundings, whether it's been in your workplace or wherever, where you've heard some of this discussion about it. And I would guess that most everyone would be like me, in the fact that there has never been a time in my life that I have not been anti-abortion. I can't remember a time where that was even entertained as a possibility, that somehow, some way, that I would think abortion would be okay. But yet in these past 2 weeks, and listening to all that's being said, it's brought something to my attention about myself that also you may share with me. And that is, I've had to ask myself the question of, well, yes, you are anti-abortion, but are you pro-life? And while those two ideas, those two thoughts are complementary, they're not synonymous. To be anti-abortion is not necessarily the same thing as being pro-life. And so this morning, what I would like to talk about is what God is saying to us about being pro-life, which I hope we're going to see by the time the sermon's over, that He very much is, and He very much wants us to be. And we'll discuss how that's relating to all these things that we're talking about in the news right now, but yet in a much broader sense of how we need, as the people of God, to be living our lives. So let's begin by first of all backing up and asking ourselves the question of how did we get here? How is it that we are at this point? So, when we think about God's attitude toward life, we know that He is a fan of it. He is the creator of life. And what God has done is He set a safe space for life. And so, I know you've been going into withdrawals for the past 3 weeks of not hearing a sermon that alludes to Genesis 1, so let's do that right now. Let's go back and talk about Genesis 1, because here's where it all begins. When God created man in His own image, in the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, now let's note what He says. He says, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Now here's the fascinating part of that. Here's the first command given to humanity. Very first thing God is going to command is, I want you to populate the earth. And so one of our purposes for being on earth is to produce more humans, and to produce them in the sense of we're creating, in a sense, with God, these little images of Him that are going to populate the earth. Now, when we've got that in mind, there are going to be a lot of things that suddenly are going to make a lot more sense to us, one of those being marriage. And so it's in marriage that God is creating this safe space for life. What He's saying is, okay, I've given you the model here. I've created a man and I've created a woman, and I want them coming together. And when they come together, I want them to produce more little humans, and I want them to be that incubator where life can flourish. And so that's what we're finding then in marriage. Now, that's also going to help us to understand some of the laws that God is going to make. I was talking to a young man yesterday about the law of Moses, and he was talking about all these weird laws in the law of Moses. And I agree, there's some in there that to our Gentile ears sound very odd. However, every one of those laws makes sense. Every one of those laws has a purpose. And sometimes when we read the law of Moses, we think, well, that's really harsh. That's really tough. And one of them being that if you committed adultery, you were to be put to death. The two that are committing adultery, you were to be taken out and you were to be killed. And we think, well, why would God create such a harsh penalty? Well, go back to point A. What is marriage supposed to be? Marriage is supposed to be this safe space for life. It's a committed man and a committed woman coming together, and they're creating this environment where new humans can come in, and that life is going to flourish. And of course, what does adultery do? It may absolutely destroy that safe space. And so God is saying, look, Israel, you're my people. You are to be that city on a hill that other nations look to so that they can see how a nation is supposed to serve God. And if you are going to be my bride, which He often compares them to, I expect fidelity from you. And one of the ways you're going to learn that is by showing fidelity to your spouse. It's protecting that safe space. We also see in the law that if fornication occurred, the man was expected to marry the woman. And if he, for whatever reason, chose not to do that, he was to give a payment to the woman's father. It's The view here is the man has come in and he's damaged that man's family. He's took something that belonged to that man, of a daughter who could be given to a man to be faithful to her to create a new home. And so God says, what I want you to do is to realize the price that's being paid because you violated my law. Now again, on the surface, if we read that from the 21st century, we think, well, that sounds awfully strange. But again, put it in context. And what we're once again seeing is that God is doing these things so that life can flourish. Now, those two examples were from the law of Moses. We don't find them brought forward into Christianity. There's no command to kill an adulterer or to force a marriage here or even a payment. But I don't want us to think for a minute that the penalties are any less serious in the days of Christianity for us. In fact, we can look at what Revelation says in chapter 21 and verse 8, where God says, but for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Now we look at that list, and maybe cowards doesn't seem to fit, but yet the rest of these we would think really egregious sins. Murder, idolatry, lying, but look what's encased right amongst those. It's the idea that if you are violating the sexual laws that God has given, the expectations, then what you are doing is you are damaging the plan that He had from the very beginning, and there will be a stiff penalty if that's not repented of and forgiven. So we take all of this together, and what we're seeing is God saying, okay, when you say I do, what you are doing is agreeing you're going to help in this plan that I started from the very beginning. And what I want you to do is to create this place, this home, where God is being honored. And so we look in the law of Moses, we look in the New Testament, and we're just going to find a plethora of things said about that, about how wives are to treat husbands and husbands, wives and parents, children and children, parents. And all of this is working to make that safe space. That's what God desires, and that's what God wants. But as we look at the history of our own nation, and I'm going to limit it to that, not try to take a worldwide view of this issue, but as we look to what our nation's history is like, what we're going to see is a walking away from what we just looked at that God desires. Let me just illustrate some of this to you. Years ago, there were laws on the books that made adultery illegal. So, if a man cheated on his wife cheated on her husband, if that spouse so desired, he could have the offending, she could have the offending party arrested, and they could be prosecuted and tried for that. Now, there's still a few of those laws on the books, but they're never prosecuted today. Well, I'm not asking us to say whether it was a good idea or bad idea. What we're doing is just looking at this from a historical perspective, that at one time, we considered adultery to be so bad that you actually had to pay a legal penalty because of that. We also see that this idea that we'll just call the shotgun weddings, that mentality is virtually gone now. Again, I'm not saying we've got to agree or disagree with it. We're just looking at the perspective. That if a man took advantage of a young lady, and the shotgun, of course, comes around from the young lady's father, that there was the expectation that this young man was going to make it right. That because he was involved in this, that a wedding was to follow. Again, that idea virtually gone within our country. We look over the past 100 years at the way divorce law has occurred. The way that it's oftentimes set up still is, for example, in the state of Alabama, not sure about other states, but it's taken as a versus. So you've got this person versus this person in getting a divorce. And it used to be that you had to have some pretty stringent reasons for that, that the law was saying that what's been joined you can't break very easily, but what's happened now is that we have divorce for virtually any reason because we've given kind of this nebulous phrase of irreconcilable differences, and with that, the judge is going to grant it. So anyone who desires a divorce is going to be able to get one. And then, of course, what we're looking at this morning is we had in 1973 this idea that abortion is now your right. You can get an abortion. And not all abortions, in fact, most of them will not, spring from adultery or fornication as we've been talking about it. But yet, that option was put on the table. That if you get involved in the wrong kind of relationship, you have the right to terminate that pregnancy. And I think that, in a lot of ways, has led to this point. That there is a decreased obligation for fathers, and mothers typically are going to be given full custodial rights of the family. I remember, you know, I haven't been in a delivery room in quite a while now, but I remember that when my kids were coming along, one of the things that shocked me the most was that I did not have to sign the birth certificate unless I wanted to. And in fact, it was more along the lines, if my wife gave me permission to. Now, what does that say? That's saying that largely the law has viewed fathers as being rather irrelevant, that while they certainly have had a part in bringing this child into the world, that it's up to the mother. Now, I want you to look at those things. Again, we're not talking about the wisdom or the not wisdom of it. We're just looking at where we've gone. And I think if you get all of that in mind, that's helping us to understand why we are where we are at this point. And so I guess it should be no surprise to us, though it always is when I go back and remind myself of this, that 40% of babies born in the United States right now are born to unwed mothers. Now, let that sink in. 40% of children coming into the world right now are not going to be born in God's safe space for life. And then of the births within the United States within a year, 14.4 abortions are going to occur per 1,000. Now that number, of course, cannot be exactly right. This is documenting those who got a medical procedure where it's on the book. There would be other situations, of course. But while a relatively low number, still significant, that you've got life that should be flourishing in a home where a father and mother are being taken away before birth even occurs. Now, with all of that said, let's kind of get to the crux of our message this morning. That as the people of God, as we kind of absorb all of this, what we're not to do is to sit around wringing our hands and say, oh, our nation is falling apart, the world is coming down, the sky is falling. That's never been what God desires. What God desires is for His people to look at this and to say, okay, what can I do about it? As an individual, as a child of God, as someone who's promoting life, what can I do in this environment? Well, here's the very first thing, and it's to realize that we never, ever need to be apologetic about supporting life, because it is an established fact within the Bible that God opposes humanity killing the unborn. How do I know that? I need only read what David says in this stirring testimony about God's view of life. David says, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. Here's David saying, what I realize is that while I had a mother and a father, I understand where my life came from. My life came from the Lord. The Lord knew what was going on. The Lord knew what was happening here. And so I don't want us to ever feel like when we're in these discussions that somehow we need to apologize for this very robust view that abortion just should not be occurring, because that's godliness. That's part of being a faithful child of God. But let's look at a second fact. And that second fact is, God also opposes an uncaring spirit. And here's where I think we get in a little bit of trouble. Oftentimes, I've noticed that when the people of God talk about abortion, there's always a tinge of anger in the voice. And I understand where that comes from. I do too. You think about here, an innocent child is not going to be able to live. But it's almost an anger that goes beyond that. An anger that just views anybody who would ever consider such a thing as this just to be totally outside the bounds of anything reasonable. Here's where we've got to think from. Because what we're finding is our upbringing is going to have a great impact on our attitude. Why have I always been an anti-abortionist? It's because from as far back as I can remember, the discussions I've had with spiritual people, the sermons I've heard, the Bible classes I've had have taught me that view. And I am so thankful for that. And I encourage any of us who have those opportunities to fully and absolutely take them. But not everybody grew up like that. Not everybody's had the opportunity to hear the sermons and the Bible classes and wise people telling you this is what God desires. And because of that, we have had a generation, or maybe two now, that have grown up who would not think like we would think. Who would not say, okay, well, I'm going to Psalm 139 and I see where God... That's just not part of the picture. Let me illustrate this. I'm going to put a quote up. I actually saved this quote several months ago, back when there was kind of a stir that this might be coming. And I just kind of set it aside because I knew at some point it would illustrate what I wanted it to. And so let me show you the attitude of somebody who didn't have this kind of upbringing, or at least didn't accept it if she did. I don't know this person. From an article, it says, for 41-year-old Rachel Dunn, who knew girls in high school and women in college and her adult life who have needed abortions, here's her quote. She says, it's just health care. Just health care. It's something that women I have known through my life have needed for different reasons, said Dunn. The government needs to step in because all these laws, she's talking about state laws, all of these laws are being written and passed, but none of them are for medical reasons. And while I've read several articles, this to me was the starkest picture of an attitude that has been totally developed without God in the picture. Where a person can say about a child and about the decision whether to allow that child to live or not, it's just health care. Now, you see the difference in that? Here's someone, me, who's always been brought up to understand life comes from God. God wants us to protect it. Here's someone who, from her statement, I am deducing that either she rejected what I had, or more likely, she never had it all. Yet, here's a generation, or again, perhaps two generations, that have come up hearing these things, growing up in an environment where abortion was legal and encouraged as a right. That's where we see the difference. So why do we need to know all of that? Well, we need to understand that because if we are going to be convincing in getting the will of God across, we've got to understand where people are coming from. Take with that the difference between having the support of a loving husband or a loving family, or both, versus being alone. I did just a little bit of research on this about reasons why women get abortions. And again, the research is, It's kind of hard to determine what's really legitimate and what's not. But one thing that did come across in several of these things that I read is that really the most prevalent reason is a young lady either does not feel like she is yet qualified to be a parent, not ready for that, or financially she can't handle it. Now, does that make sense? So here's a young lady. She's not had the advantage of perhaps growing up in the Lord. Maybe she did. But what she doesn't have is the safe space for life. She doesn't have that loving husband. Or, as happens quite often, here's a young lady who's expecting a child. The husband's out of the, or the man's out of the picture. But her family kind of rallies around her, and they may not be happy about why this child came the way that it did, but yet there's going to be no blaming that child. And so you've got grandparents and aunts and uncles, and it's kind of like this team effort of a family who rallies around a young lady. Now imagine you don't have that. You're working a job, getting $10 an hour. The man's out of the picture. Your family's not supporting you. Society is saying to you, this is a good option. Since you're not ready, it's your right after all. It's just health care. Now you see how easily someone can be persuaded to believe that this is a good decision to make. I'm not saying it's right. In fact, just the opposite. It's not a right decision. But at the point, it's an easy, short-term decision to say, this is going to get me out of a whole lot of difficulty. And that's why we have the majority of abortions in the United States performed, for that very reason. So if I'm pro-life in the way that God is directing me to be, what do I need to do about this? Well, the first thing is I need to show just as much concern for that mother as for the child. So here is this young lady, and she's feeling all alone, and maybe her family has rejected her. The husband's nowhere around. What can I do? You see, I'm anti-abortion. But yet here I'm also encouraging her to respect what life is all about. And let me say this also. It's showing concern for the father. This is a totally different sermon that needs to be preached. But the young man crisis we're having in the United States, I think, is of epic proportion. It's not getting much attention. But young men who are not being taught that they have responsibilities and that there is a consequence to their actions are being allowed to walk away almost unaffected by this. I need to be dealing with those young men. As I have the opportunity to mentor young men, to have an influence on them, to show them, that's what pro-life is all about. Now, what about in regards to the child? How am I pro-life? Well, it's first of all understanding that God has always desired that we take care of kids. Old New Testament, you find the exact same commands. We think about in Exodus 22, you shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. God's special group, the widows, the orphans, the strangers, and the poor. God says, I want you to take care of children who are in difficult situations. And it's kind of slid off the screen here. But James 1:27, I think most of us know, religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit who? The orphans. What's that saying? God's saying, when a child is brought in that does not have the advantage of this safe space that I've wanted from the beginning, you do what you can for that child. And you never take advantage. But more than that, you do something good. So what can we do? There's options. First of all, what about bringing these children into our homes? My guess is some of you have done that. That you have practiced that. A couple of years ago, my sister and brother-in-law began doing this. It was an eye-opening experience for me. The situations these little children came from. Terrible home life, of course. but now they're being put in a safe space. Can we do that? Not everybody can, but can some? Yes. But here's something everybody can do. In their experiences, I've learned something. My sister told me one day that when they first started, these are Christians, mind you, would come up to them and say, "Oh, that's just so hard." And having to say goodbye to those little kids after getting attached, I just couldn't do it. How encouraging is that? To say to someone who is trying to make a difference, "Oh, I never do that." She told me about the other side, though. She said there would be people who would come up and say, "Oh, I know that's hard. I really appreciate what you're doing." I may not can do it, but what I can do is support those who do. That's something pro-life. And it may even go a step beyond that. It may be making this child a permanent part of my family. In this congregation, we have people who have been brought into the family and who have brought others into the family because of this very thing. Here is a child. Fortunately, the decision was made by the mother for the child to be born, yet she doesn't have the resources. What do we do? Well, if I'm pro-life, I make a difference. And if I can bring that child into my home, that's exactly what I do. And if I can't do that, what I can sure do is take my money and support these legitimate programs that are aiding mothers and children in these situations. You see, that's being pro-life. That's where God is saying you're visiting the orphans in their affliction. You're taking care. You're helping. And of course, we would be remiss if we did not add the best thing we can do, and that's to pray for these situations. I wonder over the past 50 years, how many prayers have gone up that we would see morality return to our country? Has God answered that prayer? I think so. I remember those of you old enough can understand this too, that it used to be you would hear that the Lord would break down barriers, talking about the Iron Curtain of the Soviet Union, would break down barriers so that the gospel could flourish, and that, well, God did. What had to happen? Somebody had to go, right? You had men going to Russia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. Has God broken open this door? It appears, yes. What am I going to do? I'm going to pray for success, but to understand that I'm going to have a part in that. God has always expected a partnership with His people. And if I'm going to be pro-life, I've got to look at that and see what I can do. So here's my encouragement. Not that we go out and become politically active in all of this. My encouragement is we go out and we become spiritually active in all of this. We're not trying to make the evening news. We don't need to tweet about what we do. We don't need a Facebook post about it. What we need to do is just do what God expects. And that's to love life. So as I conclude this, let's remember something the Apostle Paul said. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. You did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with Him, in order that we may also be glorified with Him. Now, this illustration breaks down a bit. Every child is innocent. But the God who adopts us has taken us out of our guilt and forgiven us and brought us into His family. The God who loves life for sure also loves eternal life. And what I need to understand is that same spirit that God has had toward me, I want to have toward people who are lost, to bring them into the family of God, or maybe even to begin earlier by taking the opportunity to be pro-life and helping a child and helping a young mother, young father to find their way into this family also. Thank you for your good attention this morning. That adoption is available today. I'm glad God didn't give up on us, aren't you? I'm glad that God didn't say, well, I'm just going to forget it. This morning, think about that father in the story of the prodigal son. Longing, waiting, looking for you to come, to bring you into his family. And I want to encourage you, if you're ready to do that this morning, that you be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins so that God can adopt you and that you'll have a place in his house forever. If you need to respond, you can come while we stand and sing together.